I think we mentioned last Lord's Day morning that Job chapters 29, 30, and 31 begin the round of speeches between Job and Elihu. And then that'll be followed by some speeches from Jehovah, when Jehovah finally breaks his silence and begins to speak. Job chapter 29 is a chapter that might fit well in our society just a few years ago when the great nostalgia wave swept over the U.S. and everybody was trying to dress like the 50s because those had become the good old days before the drug hippie generation of the 60s and the things that has led to in our nation today, longing back for the good old times. And in Job chapter 29, Job takes a nostalgic look at his past before his problems began. What generally causes people to have nostalgia? Penicillin and antibiotics can't cure it, by the way. Sounds like a high-priced disease. Dissatisfaction with the present state. Life has become stagnant. Life has become unworthy. Life has become characterized by difficulties and disappointments. Life has become characterized by hard times. And about the only way that we can get around it, get over it, get through it, is to sit there and think about better days. When we enjoyed better things. When life was not so difficult. When life was not so hard. When life was not so demanding. And that basically is what we find Job doing here. As Job, in chapter 29, expresses thoughts of a happier time. If there's anything he would like to do with his present condition, it's to forget it. And he can't really forget it because he's living in the midst of it. So the closest that he can come to it is to concentrate on bygone days. And that's what Job does in 29. In verses 1 to 10, he talks about the outward aspect of his prior life. And Job again took up his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in months gone by, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone over my head, and by his light I walked through darkness. As I was in the prime of my days, when the friendship of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, and my children were around me, when my steps were bathed in butter, and the rock poured out for me streams of oil." That's a right beautiful statement, isn't it? Now, it may not be the way that you and I would express it today, but I think we understand what Job is saying. Millie's mother used to have an expression. She talked about, well, these are days when you're eating your white bread. Now, I don't know if you've heard that expression, but we've all got expressions like that, and it means that these are really the good times, or those were the good times of our lives. When life was good and everything was going our way. And yet underlying all of this, as Job remembers those days, there is an underlying implication. And what is that? When Job says, "I want to go back as in the days when God watched over me," what's he implying? God's not watching over him anymore. Those days are not these days in which I'm living. And I long for the days when God watched over me, when His lamp shone over my head, and by His light I walked through darkness. These descriptions in verse 3 are metaphorical expressions for the blessings of God. His lamp shone over my head, and by His light I walked through darkness. Darkness is a word that implies that God is not present. It implies everything that is opposite to God. And Job said, I walked through that darkness by God's light, God's presence. And that is what enabled me to endure. But now he's implying God isn't with me anymore. As I was in the prime of my days, as Job was characterized by maturity, by prosperity, that was the very good time of his days. Literally, that word translates the days of my autumn. Now, I guess we're sort of past. When does autumn begin? I guess we're still in autumn, aren't we? Winter doesn't begin till when? 21st of December. That's the start of the good time of the year, isn't it? The weather is nice. We're past the summer. The leaves are turning. Everything is rich in nature, and we just really, it's harvest time. What is not to like about autumn? And that's what Job is saying here, as I was in the prime of my days, in the autumn of my days, literally, when the friendship of God was over my tent. Number one, he says, I was a friend with God, and God was a friend with me. And where did this friendship take place? Just at the church house? Where? All the time. It was there all the time. Job says, when the friendship of God was over my tent. Now, Job's tent was his home. And it was in the home that Job enjoyed this rich relationship with God. In fact, if we're going to enjoy it, that's where it has to be enjoyed, isn't it? Because if it's not enjoyed in the home, Sunday morning is just something to do. We can't just enjoy it on Sunday morning. If God is our friend, He is our friend on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in the home as well as in the church. Job did not enjoy the friendship of God just at some holy shrine. He did not enjoy the friendship with God just when God came down and visited with him as the patriarch of his family. It was a daily relationship with God that he enjoyed. When the friendship of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me and my children were around me. What is Job saying in here made his life rich? In verse 5? His children and his God. He had good relationship with his children. He had great relationship with his God. And these are things that are traditional tokens of God's approval. Children were a traditional token of God's approval. They were a blessing from God. And not only did he enjoy a blessing from God in his children, not only did he have a prolific family, not only did he have prolific herds, he had productive fields. Sort of his herds referred to, and he says, my steps were bathed in butter. That came from his herds. And his fields were productive. The rock poured out from me streams of oil. It's literally olive oil, the good kind that was characteristic of their day and age. And the wealth that was characterized by it. These were the good times. I had my God, I had my family, I had my herds, I had my fields. And if you remember the introductory chapters to the book of Job, when all of these things were taken away from him, you can understand why Job wanted to go back in his mind and live those days again. How really good those days looked from the ash heap. But not only did he enjoy relationship with his family, relationship with his God, prolific herds and productive fields, he enjoyed great respect in the city. When I went out to the gate of the city. Now, what was the gate of? We know what the gate of the city was, but what did it stand for? What did it represent? Prominence. The gate of the city was where the business was transacted. The gate of the city was where the courts of justice met. The gate of the city was where the high muckety-mucks hung out. Now, that's a technical legal term if you don't understand high muckety-muck. But that's where the big dogs went. That's another technical legal term. Just to express what the gate of the city was. Job says, I went out to the gate of the city, and I took my seat in the square. Job was a leader in the community. He was somebody that was looked up to. He was somebody that enjoyed prominence. And listen to it now. The young men saw me and hid themselves. Job's public image here is projected by two images, young men and old men. Now, you know, there was a day, and I think I use the word was advisedly, that when an older person walked into the room, the young people stood up, showing respect. Now, I'm not sure but what that hadn't already faded by the time I came along as a young person. But I've heard my daddy say, if when he was a boy and an older person walked into the room and he didn't stand up, he'd gotten his ears boxed. And Job is saying here, when I came up to the city gate and when I took my seat there, the young men saw me and hid themselves, and the old men arose and stood. Job was so prominent, Job was so respected, that not just the youngsters would stand up and hide themselves, but the older folks would stand up in admiration and respect for Job. In fact, you know, if we had princes around there, now these were the people that really had position. They were the people who had the royal blood. They were of the kingly lineage. The princes stopped talking and put their hands on their mouths. The voice of the nobles was hushed, and their tongue stuck to their palate. Now, what do you reckon Job's saying there? Their voice is hushed, their tongues stuck to their palate.
He was rather awe-inspiring person.
And what happens when an awe-inspiring personage walks into your presence? You get nervous, Bill? Yeah, most of us get nervous. And we want to talk, but we just can't quite get it out. Our tongue stammers. Our tongue sticks to our palate. And that's what Job is saying here about these folks. When he walked in, the room went quiet, and the folks were so nervous they couldn't talk. You know, I was older when I went to law school. I tell folks I was never a young lawyer. I was just an inexperienced lawyer. And I figured by the time I started law school, I heard some of the fellows that were starting law school talk about, oh, I'm just so afraid. And I thought, gosh, I've been around and not any of these professors going to make me nervous. And I never will forget the day that one of the professors, Professor Shellhouse, called on me for the first time. He'd always walk up, put his foot on the chair sort of right in front of you and say, Mr. Hall. And I guarantee you, with Shellhouse, I started off stammering. And I didn't recover till he said, where'd you get that answer? And I said, I don't know. It's not in the case. And then I went on and briefed the case for him and finally got it right. But that just happens. And that's what Job is saying was the reaction that these folks had to him. They just stuttered. They stammered. They stopped. They listened to what Job had to say. Verses 11 to 17. Why did Job enjoy this honored position? What was the cause that created it? And Job is going to tell us here in verses 11 to 17, it was his righteousness, it was his benevolence that caused people to have this attitude toward him. For when the ear heard, it called me blessed or happy. Recognize that Job was receiving and deserving of the blessings of God. And when the eye saw, it gave witness of me. Now, beginning in verse 12, Job tells us that this attitude toward him was not the kind of obsequious, fawning honor that we sometimes give undeserving people because they've got a lot of money and they've gotten some kind of political power, economic influence. But it is something that Job deserved because of what he did. Turn back to chapter 22, by the way. I want to remind you of something that Eliphaz said about Job. For you have taken, this is verse 6 and 7, for you have taken pledges of your brothers without cause and stripped men naked. To the weary you have given no water to drink, and from the hungry you have withheld bread. Isn't it amazing how sometimes when we want to make a point, we just ignore, misconstrue, or misstate the facts? That's what Eliphaz had done. He was trying to say, Job, you're getting all this because you're wicked. And the only thing that he could think of to support his cause was to make these false accusations against Job. Here is what the community testified about Job. When the eye saw, it gave witness of me because I delivered the poor who cried for help. The hearers of his deeds praised him. The observers gave witness. I delivered the poor who cried for help and the orphan who had no helper. The blessing of the one ready to perish came upon me. He ministered to those who were in despair, ready to perish. And the next statement is a beautiful statement. And I made the widow's heart sing for joy. What does James tell us that pure and undefiled religion is? To visit the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And Job is saying here, I made the widow's heart sing for joy. Well, Job, is this just all talk? We've got Eliphaz saying one thing about you, and we've got you saying something else. Job says the community witnesses to what I did. But let's look at verse 14. Job says, what I did and the exercise of my righteousness, the doing of good, was publicly visible to everybody. I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. It wasn't just talk. He was clothed in it. He was dressed in it so everybody could see it, observe it, and know that it was true. Brother Bill?
This is not to be misconstrued that he wore his righteousness as a loose garment.
Not to be construed that he wore his righteousness as a loose garment. Somebody turn over to Romans chapter 13 and read verse 14 for us. Just read it real loudly, because not everybody is turning. Put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. You and I, like Job was clothed in his righteousness, you and I are to be clothed in Jesus Christ. And that leads to certain kinds of conduct. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 4. And this time, verses 22 to 24. If you have it, go ahead and start. Could go on and read the following verses, but that describes what is included in putting off the old man and putting on the new man, being clothed in the new man. I used to preach a sermon on this passage called The Rags of the Old Man, The Robes of the New. And when you read that passage, you can see what the robe of the new man is in Ephesians chapter 4. But we are to put it on. We are to wear it. Our righteousness is to be as a robe to us, so those around us can see Jesus Christ in us. Well, how in the world are we robing Jesus Christ? Where does it start? Brother Bob. Galatians 3:27. What does it say? All right. For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ did put on Jesus Christ, literally have been clothed in Jesus Christ. That's where it has its starting place. And then we are to wear Jesus Christ so that people see our good works and are led to glorify our Father in heaven. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. Verse 15 is just a beautiful verse. It describes the significance of Job's piety in the community, the social significance of it. Listen to it. I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. Isn't that a beautiful description of Job's righteousness? As he continues to talk about what he did, I was a father to the needy. What does a father do for his children? He clothes them. He feeds them. He provides for them. Job says, I was a father to the needy. Job fed them. Job protected them. Job provided for them. Well, Job, you know, you just sort of sat around. If somebody ever came around and sort of needed a little help, then you just sort of pitched them a little. Mm-mm. Job went looking for it. And I investigated the case which I did not know. Job sought out those who needed his help. Those who are in the positions that Job has described are as prey to the wild beasts. And so Job talks about his protection. I broke the jaws, literally fangs or gnawing teeth, of the wicked and snatched the prey from his teeth. Job rescued the poor. And not only did Job rescue the poor, but he destroyed the oppressor. Who would oppress the poor? Well, you might expect that a man like this would be honored. And in verses 18 to 25, Job talks about the honor that was his. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters, and dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is ever new with me, and my bow is renewed in my hand. Job was praised and honored by man and by God. And Job's life was so good that Job thought he would live to a ripe old age. And that when he died, he'd die surrounded by his children. Then I thought, I shall die in my nest. It just never dawned on Job in the good days when he had his God, his children, his prolific herds, and his productive fields, that he would wind up on the ash heap. He did have expectations. I shall die in my nest, ripe old age. My days shall multiply as the sand. Prosperous. He was going to die a wealthy man. His prosperity is described by the image of the tree, and the image of the tree with a strong root that goes down into the waters below and is gently bathed by the dew upon its branches at nighttime, so that everything is a picture of prosperity and sweetness. His respect and his rank, his social prominence would continue unabated. My glory is ever new with me. And my bow, my strength, is renewed in my hand. It is good, and it shall continue so. And nobody else thought any differently. Verses 21 to 25 describes their attitude, the response that others afforded when he spoke. To me, they listened and waited and kept silence for my counsel. Was Job the E.F. Hutton of his day? When E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen, or so we are told. When Job spoke, they did listen. They waited and kept silent for my counsel. Let us not speak. Let us just sit in silence and wait for Job's wisdom. After my words, they did not speak again, and my speech dropped on them. When Job had spoken, there was no more to say. You know anybody like that? Do what? Which one? I know some folks that think they're in this category. I know some folks who are always so willing to talk and so willing to talk at length that when they're through, there's no time to say anything. But I don't know of anybody who, when he or she speaks, there is nothing left that can be said, nothing that can be added. But that is exactly the reputation that Job had, and my speech dropped on them. What's he talking about there? My speech dropped on them. What's that?
He told
them. He taught them?
Told them.
He did tell them. And my speech dropped on them. What about Zacchaeus? Rains came down. That's what Job's saying here. My speech came down on them as blessing rain. Look at verse 23. That would have given you a hint. And they waited for me as for the rain, and opened their mouth as for the spring rain. His hearers absorbed his words like the parched ground receives the blessing rain. That was as Job's words to his hearers. But there are always some skeptics. And surely Job, with his position, with his prominence, with everything that Job had going for him, with the attitude that everybody else had to him, would get in the face of the skeptic and say, "Who do you think you are that you don't accept what I say?" I smiled on them when they did not believe, and the light of my face they did not cast down. Job did not get upset with people who did not believe what he had to say. Maybe he just thought, well, someday they'll come around. But he didn't let it get him down. The light of my face they did not cast down. Those who were unbelieving, those who were despondent, did not affect Job's cheerfulness and his attitude toward life. I don't know who Job had in mind here when he talks about the light of my face they did not cast down, who these despondent folks were, not described for us. But you and I both know some folks who aren't having a good time unless they're absolutely miserable, who are only happy when something is going wrong, and who glory in their infirmity. And Job says, I didn't let those folks, the folks who have nothing good to say, nothing positive to say, who go through life despondent, they didn't affect my attitude. My face they did not cast down. I chose a way for them and sat as chief and dwelt as king among the troops as one who comforted the mourners. When Job gave instructions, Job's instructions were carried out. He sat as the chief, he sat as the king. And those are people whose instructions are followed. If you haven't read chapter 30, Stan, that's a very good observation, because one of the things we're going to see in chapter 30 is that this was one of the greatest losses that Job suffered. He is indeed reminiscing. I think, though, that Job is probably not stretching too much, except when he used hyperbole to describe the butter and the oil that bathed his paths and ran from rocks. But that's simply descriptive to describe the great blessings. And we know that literally that was true because we read the opening part of the book. Any other questions or comments here? Well, we don't have time to get into chapter 30. I've got... when's the first bell ring?
3 minutes ago.
Why didn't I hear it? Why didn't you ring it? Well, I missed it again this morning. It did? Didn't? Okay, good. See there, I'm not going deaf. But let's stop here and let me take just a minute or two and ask you to read very carefully for next Lord's Day, chapter 30. Because in chapter 30, Job gets over his nostalgia and he really starts describing what he has lost. Look at it from that standpoint and do something else. I did hear that one. Bob went and rang it. When you read chapter 30, go back and read chapter 3. If you recall, chapter 3 we called Job's Lamentation. And Job's Lamentation came right after all of the losses that Job had suffered in chapters 1 and 2. You recall he was ready to die. He wanted to go to the grave. It was a bleak, bleak picture. Now, there are some similarities between chapter 3 and chapter 30. But there are some differences. So look at chapter 3 and chapter 30 and see if you can figure out the similarities and the differences. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we get into chapter 30 next Lord's Day morning. Appreciate your